One of the questions that was raised recently to me was what is it actually that makes us, or what is it that defines us as a Buddhist, or what makes us into a Buddhist? What does it mean to be a Buddhist? What do we have to do, or what do we have to not do? What distinguishes us? It was quite interesting thinking about that sort of various sort of names sort of popped up, like, you know, you have the idea of an armchair Buddhist, or you know, you got an idea of a you know, like a scholar Buddhist. You know, these are the scholar Buddhists, you know, these are the armchair Buddhists, and these are the these are the meditators, and these are the this and that. And so people, you know, even in Buddhism, have this idea of sort of these, you have these little factions there, you know. But I'm actually a practicing Buddhist. That was the distinction. I'm a practicing Buddhist. You know, I'm not just paying lip service to the Buddhist teachings. I'm a practicing Buddhist. You know, but he's just Buddhist by birth. Or Buddhist by cultural background, or whatever. Yeah. And so it was an interesting thing to sort of contemplate, you know, what is it that makes us into a Buddhist? What is it that really, you know, how do you recognize a Buddhist? How do you recognize a Christian? How do you recognize among people from other denominations? And it's quite interesting. Yesterday, the monks had to go and do some chanting for someone who killed himself, and the people weren't actually Buddhists. And in fact, the monks told me when they went, the people there sort of were wearing quite big crosses, obviously being Christians, Catholic. And so I had a sort of not quite a thought which wasn't quite free of cynicism, and I thought, I wonder whether they got the local imam as well, and whether they got perhaps the local rabbi as well, just to cover all their bets, you know, so that the person is going to go to a good place. But I always feel when you have these sort of so-called interfaith meetings, you know, sort of it's like, you know, sort of Christians always wear that big cross, don't they? And I always feel a bit like a vampire, I must admit, sort of like... So what is it? What do the Buddhists wear? I mean, of course we have our medallions, and we have our little amulets and Buddha statues that people wear and that. But yeah, is it that? You know, what you know? And for me, like when I just look back at the sort of Buddhists or the people that I met that actually really resonated with me, or really sort of made a very deep and profound impression on me, and which you know, partly was you know, the reason for me to become interested in Buddhism. And I was sort of looking back, and well, what was it actually, you know, in those people, or what was it about the Buddhists that made me have faith or gain faith in the Buddhist teachings? And you know, apart from obviously the great monks that I've met, you know, who developed the path, you know, very, very high, you know, to the point of attaining enlightenment and these sorts of things, and having all these weird and wonderful powers. But just more on an ordinary level, you know, the ordinary Buddhists, you know, practicing, so-called practicing Buddhists. I think practicing Buddhists is probably the right word, because you'd expect that they're actually putting the Buddhist teachings into practice. But it was more the result of having put the Buddhist teachings into practice. And that result, to me, always was that kind of... It was that evenness. There's an evenness about these people. And a sense of... a deep inner sense of contentment. And, you know, they weren't easily shaken in the midst of, you know, be it praise or blame, or be it happiness and suffering, be it gain and loss. You know, those worldly dhammas, you know, that, you know, we meet with from time to time. You know, praise and blame, happiness and suffering, you know, fame and ill repute, gain and loss. Those are the things that go up and down with the world. And in the midst of that, the people that to me always stood out were those who maintained that calm and peace and evenness, no matter what life had to offer, as it were. And that obviously must have come from, you know, having actually put the Buddhist teachings into practice. And also the thing about, you know, practicing Buddhists is always to have, I don't know, for me I call it like that sort of sparkle in the eyes. It's like kind of like it's a cheerfulness, but it's a laid backness. I don't know, you can't really describe it. There's many different words you could put, but perhaps just think for yourself, you know, what it is that, you know, that it, what was it about, you know, practicing Buddhists that you've met that led you to take on the Buddhist teachings in earnest and practice them. And when I say that sparkle, it's like, and that's why I always make that point, even in the meditation just before as well, about retaining that interest and that enthusiasm, you know, and that almost like that passion about what we're doing, so that, you know, we never actually take what we're doing for granted. We never become dull about what we're doing. Yeah, dull is like, you know, quite a good contrast to that sparkle in the eyes of people. And when I say sparkle, I don't really mean the sort of starry-eyedness, because we also have that, don't we? I mean, people are sort of starry-eyed and they're really enthusiastic and they go and they want to convert everybody because Buddhism is just so great and everybody become a Buddhist, you know. But that sometimes doesn't last all that long, does it? I mean, you get people that get very enthusiastic about something, and then that enthusiasm sort of wears itself out with time. But that's what I mean with that evenness. It's like people who can sustain the practice are the ones that get results in the practice, and then the result is that evenness, is that ability to deal with life appropriately, no matter what life has to offer. And so, with life being, you know, living in a, I'm always tempted to call it a barbarian culture, in a sense that, you know, most people, you know, aren't very spiritual, in a sense, you know. And so to sustain that enthusiasm, interest, passion, our devotion to the practice, to actually putting the Buddhist teachings into practice, is not easy, is it? It's very difficult. Because we're not always confronted with things that support a spiritual pursuit, a spiritual path. You know, keeping precepts, being generous, being kind, being tolerant, being compassionate. It's not always the things that we see around us. And so, to actually maintain that kind of idealism or ideal about the practice is not easy. Yeah? And so we have to find ways and means of, as it were, sustaining or retaining the worthiness of being called a practicing Buddhist. Yeah? Because a lot of times when we become used to something, we just go through the motions, isn't it? You know, we just, you know, do our little thing there, and it kind of, you know, sort of self-perpetuates itself, but it doesn't really bring the results. And so one of the important things is to always, you know, have that interest to actually see and look and observe ourselves and our state of mind and our state of happiness and peace and calm, and in terms of cause and effect, so that we can actually see, well, is what we are doing, is what we are practicing leading to the goal that we have? And that obviously presupposes the fact that we have a goal, because if we don't have a goal, then we won't have the means really to make effort. We have to have goals. We have to have ideals. We have to have set ourselves, certain goals that we want to attain, and then actually observe and, watch ourselves as we practice along this path to see, how actually our actions of body, speech and mind, how the way we actually do put the Buddha's teachings into practice, how that actually affects our state of mind, our state of being. Just comes to mind, I remember in Thailand, one of the most famous monks in the Thai forest tradition, who was more or less almost like the founder of the Thai forest tradition, is Lumpu Man, Tanzan Man. And he was heard by a layperson once to have said that it's a bit of a pun on words, and so it's like for the Thais who are here, I say it, and so my raksa sin, and raksa means actually looking after, but it can also mean cultivate. He said, I don't look after, or I don't cultivate all those 227 rules of a monk. And so then that layperson sort of heard, what, Lumpu Man, the great Lumpu Man, is not looking after his monk's precepts, he's not cultivating the monk's precepts. And that was obviously quite a bit of a shock for him and or her, I can't remember. And then that person went to see Lumpu Man, made the effort, made the determination to go and look for him, because that intrigued that person very much. And so when he actually came to see Lumpu Man, he said, oh, Lumpu, I heard you don't look after your monk's precepts, which are, as you know, quite numerous, 227. And Lumpu Man said, no, I just look after one precept, and that is my mind. Or I look after one thing, and I look just, that's all I look after, that's all I cultivate, and that's my mind. And obviously, you can see, it's in a way, it's just a play on words, but obviously, coming from someone so highly attained, like Tanzan Man, is obviously a very profound statement there. And so in the practice, we have to really see that the goal, ultimately, is always to look after our mind, to cultivate and look after our mind, because that's the most precious thing we have, because everything else, just comes and goes. States of mind come and go, and material things come and go. Yeah. But when we, I always say, when we close our eyes at night and go to sleep, then we are with our own mind. We are with ourselves, as it were. Yeah. And it is the status quo, as it were, of our mind. The state of mind is just so important. And so we have to always keep track of that state of mind. How do things affect us? And how do we deal with things? And how does it all work together? So how does the actual keeping of the precepts, for instance, affect our mind? How does our practice of compassion in action, or generosity, kindness, liberality, tolerance, how do these things, how do we put them into practice, and how do they in turn affect our mind? And how can we even put them into practice in a world where a lot of these things oftentimes aren't even appreciated, without being someone who wears, as it were, that big cross, or for a Buddhist, it'd be the Dhammacakka. So we don't want to sort of impose on other people either. We don't want to go out and convert everybody, or tell everybody how great we are, or how great Buddhism is. But how can we just in a gentle way kind of do the practice, And I always like that word, I think it's called prodding along. Because I remember my first teacher in Thailand, he used that a lot. I never really sort of researched, where it came from, or where the wording came from, but I got the feeling of what he meant with that, and it was, for me, it was always that sustained effort, of just prodding along, just being willing to just keep doing what you're doing, in your own little humble, sometimes stumbling and crawling ways, just doing what you're doing, and just prodding along gradually, gently, you know, little by little, step by step, peacefully, contentedly, just doing your thing. And but we can only do that when we keep track of how it actually affects us, yeah, so that we can sustain the interest. Because when we see that certain things have certain effects, good effects, bad effects, you know, then, you know, we can actually, we actually want to make the effort. Yeah? We want to put more effort into, say, an act of generosity, yeah? Like an act of charity. You know, we give 100%. We put our heart into it. Yeah? And by putting our heart into things, by doing them with that sharpness, with that crispness of attention, yeah, we actually are much more aware and much more mindful, to use that well-worn word, of what we're actually doing. And it is the mindfulness and the awareness, the sharpness, the alertness around doing the things that we're doing that brings back or brings out the results or the effects of things, as opposed to just doing things because we've always done it, or because my friends do it, or my parents do it, or my mother does it, or, you know, I was told that's the thing to do. Yeah. So it's the amount of effort we put into what we're doing with the intention of finding out how it actually affects us, that, you know, is what really propels us along this path in a very efficient and very beautiful way, and it leads to the desired results. And it's like you give a simile, like you can have say you want to cross a desert, say, and it's this long journey that you have to go on to. And you know it's going to be really hot, you know, and it's not going to be very pleasant, but you got to get through that desert, as it were, you know. And so you can, so there's different ways, different attitudes with which you can set out on that journey, isn't it? I mean, you can have that attitude of, yeah, I'm going to do it, you know, and you just pack your bags and you just, you know, get everything and just, yeah, and just start running, you know. And after the first couple of hundred meters, you know, you pour out in a sweat and you just break down and you just drink all your water and you just die miserably. You never actually make it even halfway into the desert because you haven't paced yourself. You know, you've just been too full on, and you know, you've blown all your energies very quickly, and then you know, you never really have that sustained ability to sustain the effort, so you never really last the distance, never last to the journey. And of course the other extreme is you sort of, you know, think, oh, I've got to get through that desert. Well, maybe I just have a drink first, and, you know, sort of, oh, it's this nice shady tree here, you know, and they sort of, yeah, and then you contemplate the desert, and you think about it, and, you know, you fantasize about it, and you dream of the results, and but you never actually get yourself together to actually make the journey. You're never actually going on the journey. You're just dreaming about it, thinking about it, you know. Or maybe there's this sort of first oasis. You just about make it there, and then you just, oh wow, this is great. You know, look at these palm trees and look at the water here, and this is great. You know, and just hang out there, and you just never make it to the next mark. Yeah. So, and with the path, with the practice, I remember Achan Piak, I think actually it was, he said, Nibbana isn't all that far, you know? You know, and he gave that simile. He said, look, it's like going from here to, just to give a simile here, it's like going from here to Bunbury or something like that, you know? And it's not all that far, you know, Nibbana isn't all that far. But it's just the fact, the reality is, you know, people set out, you know, I'm going to go to Nibbana. And then, you know, sort of they get down to Northbridge and that's it for the next, you know, long while. And then they're just about, you know, to think, oh, okay, I'm going to make another leap. No, it's not all that far. Let's go for it, you know. get on, and then they sort of, you know, ah, that's sort of interesting over there. So you hang out in Berthwood for a little while, and then they finally get down to sort of, you know, Serpentine. You come and stay in the monastery for a while, and then hang out in Mandra for a while. And by the time you get down to sort of, you know, past Mandra, you sort of, you know, die of old age. So it's like pacing ourselves, and you know, being able to have that sustained effort, you know, but always checking up on the results, always being someone who is observant, looking to see what we're doing. Yeah, and it's where do we have to put most of our attention in the practice? And I remember, you know, Ajahn Brahm used to make a point of that, you know, quite recently, and you know, I was reminded of the fact that there's in Buddhism we have this what would they call vata, which basically means circle or cycle, yeah? And which just to simplify it, you know, for the you know purpose of this talk, it means like, you know, we have the experience of life. You know, in other words, we have the things that we meet with through the senses. You know, what we experience every day. Yeah? But then there is also the mind, as it were. You know, that which actually experiences it. You know, which, you know, it may not be for the scholars here not so accurate to call it the experiencer and the experience, but just for the sake of simplification and practicality, you know. There is the experience of life, and there is the person, if you want to call it a non-self, you may go ahead now and call it a non-self, that experiences the experience, okay? But the point is, in terms of practice and walking this path in order to see what we're doing, is the important place to put our awareness, to put our attention, is actually the place where we react to the experience. In other words, the mind quite happily experiences anything, because it hasn't got a vested interest in what it experiences. The mind simply knows. Yeah? It knows pain, it knows pleasure. It knows sight, sound, smells, tastes and touches, and it knows thoughts. It knows the pleasant ones, it knows the unpleasant ones. But it just knows. Yeah? So the mind is just that which knows, and it quite happily knows just about anything. Yeah? And that's why there's beautiful simile of, I think it's from Venerable Sariputta. He said to make your mind like the earth, or make the mind like the water, or like fire. Yeah? Because, you know, the elements, you know, they just about, you know, encounter anything without complaining. Yeah? Or as one of the Kubajans said, he said, you have to make your mind like a Buddha Rupa. You know, these big golden Buddha Rupas, you know, you can do anything you want with them. They never complain, they never say anything, you know. They always just sit there, you know, perfectly peaceful, with a light, with a beautiful smile. Make your mind like a Buddha Rupa. And of course, that's the ideal. But the reality, obviously, is in how do we react to life? And how do we react to experience, to the things that come into contact with our senses? Through sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, through the mind. Yeah. And it's that point where we have to practice. That's the point of practice. That's the point where we put the Buddha's teachings into practice. Because that's where defilements arise, isn't it? Yeah. That's where desire and aversion arises. Yeah. That's where liking and disliking arises. Yeah. That's where, you know, greed, jealousy, anger, lust, fear, boredom, now, all these mind states arise from that point where, which is between, as it were, the knowing and the known. The known is the object, which is the experience of life. The knower is the mind, that which knows. But it's in the middle there, somewhere, where we react to life, where we create, as it were, karma. Where we create the future. Because what we experience, quite frankly, is quite passive in a sense. Most often there is not much we can do about the experience. When we see something, well, that's it. We just see it. When we hear something, we hear it. When we smell something, we smell it. Taste, touch, a thought comes and goes, and it comes again, it goes again, and we can't really control it very much. But still, we react with liking and disliking, and it's at that point where the practice is, where we create in our future through the way we react to experience. And so when I say putting the Buddha's teachings into practice, is that the point of our experience, how we react to it, and how we create our future experience? Because it's the attitude or the attitude to life that really determines or distinguishes us as a Buddhist. And what is a Buddhist attitude to life? What is a Buddhist attitude to experience? What is a Buddhist, what is a true Buddhist, as it were, relationship to the things that come into contact with into contact with the senses? That's, I think, where as Buddhists we really distinguish ourselves, because as a Buddhist, if we truly follow the Buddhist teachings, we're not necessarily after just accumulating pleasant experiences and frantically avoiding everything that is vaguely unpleasant. But the Buddhist attitude to life is to take life as a means to understanding, to developing wisdom, to cultivate enlightenment little by little, to awaken to the truth of the fact that whatever we experience, be it pleasant or unpleasant, in the end it's going to be impermanent anyway. So what's the big deal? But that's, of course, where the difficulty is, isn't it? Because defilement doesn't work like that. And defilement has a vested interest in what it experiences. It has a vested interest to avoid unpleasant experiences and to amass pleasant experiences. But that's the point, that's the place where, you know, we really can distinguish ourselves as a Buddhist, when we actually take what life has on offer as a means to cultivate and develop wisdom and understanding and peace. So that, you know, whatever we experience, we maintain, as I said in the beginning, that evenness, that sort of, you know, sustain a kind of calmness and coolness in the mind. And so that we actually look after the mind and not letting the mind go up and down with the experiences so much. Experiences will go up and down. That's just the nature of them, isn't it? I mean, you know, now we're happy, now we're sad, you know, now we like things, now we don't like things, and now it's too hot, now it's too cold. You know, there's always the ups and downs of life. But is that really where we take refuge as a Buddhist? Is it really in the experience? Because that is, yes, that's the ordinary, way of everybody else, you know, out there in the big world. But, you know, what really distinguishes us as a Buddhist is to take it serious when the Buddha said that cultivating the mind is the most important thing. Looking after the mind is the most important thing. Making sure that, first of all, we get a feeling for what is this mind? What is it? What is it that we are with when we are alone? You know, and for a change, there isn't the endless array of thoughts going on. Just the peaceful knowing, the peaceful awareness, the peaceful being in the present moment. And of course, we can only really get a hold of that through meditation. But nevertheless, we can, you know, little by little move towards that experience by putting the Buddha's teachings into practice when it comes to, you know, things like keeping the precepts, practicing generosity, being kind, being tolerant. And it is observing ourselves at those places where we make contact with the world that we learn and where things will start to change for us. So we have to make that determined effort to be alert at the point of contact with the world, at the point of experience. So that when we experience things, whether it's at work, whether it's with friends, whether it's with family, whatever it is, to always have that presence of mind, or to at least aim for that. I know how difficult it is. I mean, even as a monk, you know, trying to practice for many years now. But it is that repeated effort, that bringing ourselves back again and again, patiently, to observe and look and not get complacent, and to give 100%. Because like I said, it's in the giving of 100% that mindfulness increases, and with the increasing of mindfulness, our memory and our ability to remember increases as well, so that we can later on remember. If we don't put effort into whatever it is, if we don't put the effort into it, then the mind hasn't got the ability to remember it. That's why people will always remember what they call traumatic experiences, because there was an intense amount of mindfulness around that very experience, except that usually traumatic experience is generally a negative one. But if you can understand the point of that, is that the more aware, the more alert we are around experiencing life, the more we can remember it, the more interesting for one it becomes, and the more interesting it is, the more interest we can put into it or sustain. And so it's all these sort of factors of the path, they're working together. You know, you have to have the right view to know that this is important, you know, to look at our reaction to life, you know, between, as it were, the knowing and the known, you know, to watch at the place where defilement arises, greed, hatred, delusion, anger, and so on and so forth. That's right view that informs us of the importance of keeping track of our mind all the time. And then with that right view, if we have the right view that this is an important thing to do, this is how we cultivate the Buddhist path, then with that right view, we can have the right intention to, you know, again and again move in that direction and remind ourselves persistently, you know, bring ourselves back to the teachings, remind ourselves of the teachings, and have the intention of loving kindness, have the intention, form the intention in the mind of non-cruelty, of harmlessness, of gentleness, compassion, tolerance. So when those ideals, those principles, when they actually become, as it were, second nature to us, that is the time when, as it were, we're well on the path, and we start to, as it were, embody like someone who is truly worthy of this word I mentioned in the beginning, practicing Buddhist, you know, because it's someone who is. You have to start experiencing the results of the practice in order to get even more interest to keep practicing it. And so it's like a self-perpetuating path. If we don't get the results, sooner or later, we kind of give up. But if we give up, we don't get the results. And so in the beginning, it's like, you know we got to get through that desert. And we know it's going to be tough. And so in the beginning, to sustain that effort, to sustain the mindfulness, to sustain the interest and the reminding ourselves of putting effort into whatever we're doing, it's very difficult. That's the hard yard, as it were, and that we have to go through. But then little by little, when the results start coming, you know, we can actually go through life with more and more of a smile. And that's the beauty of people, you know, you notice, you know, around you who've been practicing for a long time. For those who for whom, like the five precepts, become perfectly natural. Yeah, you know, they wouldn't even form the intention anymore, you know, to kill, you know, intentionally kill an animal or something like that. Or, you know, stealing is just so far removed from their mind, you know, they'd never even conceive of trying to rip somebody off, you know, or committing adultery or getting drunk or whatever, you know. So it's like when these things have become second nature, yeah, that's when the beauty of those results actually start to come to the fore in people. And that's just so nice to see, so inspiring to see when people don't have to force themselves anymore to, you know, be a good person, basically. I remember I think it's some philosopher, he said, you know, in the beginning he said he had to sort of really force his mind and always sort of, you know, be there with a whip almost, you know, in the beginning. And then he said, but in the end, you know, my mind naturally was like that. You know, I didn't have to force it anymore. I didn't have to push it anymore. You know, the mind would just naturally incline to beautiful thoughts and to kind thoughts. And so then things like loving kindness and compassion become also second nature, in the sense that loving kindness becomes an attitude to life, you know, and it becomes a way in which we relate to life. Yeah? So this whole idea in the beginning, which is just like a verbalization of, oh, may all beings be well, may all beings be happy, may all beings be peaceful, may all beings be free, you know, from all suffering. In the beginning, those are just thoughts. Yeah? But the more we wear them into the mind, the more the more the mind becomes drenched, as it were, by those thoughts and intentions and wholesome ways of thinking, yeah? The more it becomes like an attitude to life. Yeah? So wherever we go, you know, we almost embody this may all beings be well, because we don't wish harm to anybody. We don't wish ill will to anybody. And obviously those people, and that was one of those crucial little lines that I remember from one of the recent visits of some of the Kobachan. And he said, it's actually the monk he brought with him, Tan Puton, and he said that, you know, true loving kindness comes from seeing suffering. And for those who know that seeing suffering is almost like synonymous with being a stream enterer, because when you see the first noble truth, you have a full insight into the first noble truth of dukkha, seeing dukkha, seeing suffering, then you actually are a stream enterer. And so what he was saying there was very profound. He said, well, it's the seeing of dukkha in all beings that actually is the true beginning of loving kindness, because it's when you see dukkha in everything, everywhere, all around you. Yeah? For most people that seems terrible. Why do I want to see suffering everywhere? It's a terrible thought. Yeah? But the reality is, you know, once again, 180 degrees against the grain of the world is the moment we see suffering. Yeah? That's the time when we start to have real compassion. That's the time when we have real loving kindness, and because we know, you know, what people are going through, what is actually going on, and so then it comes really deep from the heart, you know, that really true heartfelt, you know, wish and intention of may all beings be well, may they be happy, may they be free from suffering, becomes almost like a natural expression of the mind of someone who's seen the Dhamma. And so a very, very beautiful, very profound little statement there. But on the small level, for us, it also means that the more we actually experience the Dhamma, the more we experience the fruits of the Buddhist teachings, the more we can actually be an example for others, and the more we actually become an inspiration to others. But also, we become a reminder to ourselves, because the more we experience the results of the Buddhist teachings, and the more we actually want to practice, And so it becomes this sort of self-sustaining, self-perpetuating process of cause and effect. So that's one thing that I always like to make a strong thing out of, is for people to always be able to, or always be willing to bring themselves back to trying to figure out, you know, how things affect ourselves, you know, how cause and effect actually works, how whatever we say affects us, how whatever we do affects us, how whatever we think affects us, you know, how it bears on the mind, because it is the mind that we have to look after. And so whatever we do through body, speech and mind, through keeping the precepts or not keeping the precepts, how does it affect us? And what does it do to us? And how does it actually change or modify our level of happiness, our level of well-being, our level of peace and understanding? So that is where the practicing Buddhist should really aim at, is those things that lead to being able to more and more realize the fruits, and then through realizing the fruits, wanting to put in more causes, and realizing even more fruits, and so to be someone who persistently keeps up the effort, and as it were, as I said in the beginning, not in the sort of over enthusiastic way, but prodding along, little by little. Because I've seen monks, people ordaining, and they were just super geng, as they call in Thai, they were the best upataks, and they were the best attendant monks, and they were the best this and the best that, and they were just so outstanding. And now they're married, and not that it's a bad thing to be married. I'm not saying, but what I'm saying is, like, it's not always what it seems, So it's like sometimes you look at the people, the sort of quietly working in the background there, not making a big deal, not sort of showing off, but just gradually putting in the work, little by little. Doing their thing for the benefit of all people that they are with, And it's that persistency, that gradualness that really leads to the best results, But again, the danger is and is that it becomes almost like this going through the motion, like becoming complacent, and that's the danger there. So we have to find that right way, that middle way, where we can keep that sparkle going. That just the middle way is the sparkle, like I call the sparkle, which is between the dullness and the starry-eyedness. Just to keep kindling and rekindling our interest through reading up on the Buddhist teachings, through talking with our friends, talking about practice, listening to Dhamma talks. Because we have to remind ourselves, we have to be reminded, because if we're not reminded, then we forget. We very easily forget. That's just the nature of ourselves, of the mind. As somebody said, it's the mind, the nature of the mind is is like water. It always runs to the lowest spot. And if we don't make effort, then the mind has a nature like water. It just runs to the lowest spot and we become low. And that's how samsara sustains itself. It doesn't matter how high you get. Sooner or later, you got to come down again. That's just the truth of rebirth. Doesn't matter what lofty heavenly beings you get reborn into. Sooner or later, you got to come down again. Why is that? Because it's the nature of the mind that is unenlightened. It always goes to the lowest spot. And it's easy to do evil, but it's difficult to do good. It's easy to be lazy, but it's difficult to make effort. And so, finding that middle way, of sustaining our practice, sustaining our interest, you know, sustaining our enthusiasm, our passion, if you like, rekindling it, and then always watching, you know, cause and effect, how do things affect ourselves? And then little by little, you know, prodding along, we make our way, and you know, eventually it'll lead to the desired results. And never forgetting the Buddha's a beautiful teaching on the fact that patience is the supreme, what do you call it, scorcher of defilements or something like that. It's the supreme quality is patience and endurance. And I know even the monks in the monastery, when I say that, sometimes I kind of feel like I'm preaching and lecturing because they don't want to hear it. Yeah? Patience, endurance. Instant! I want instant gratification. Now! And I want it now! And of course it never happens. You know, it never happens now. It happens at its own time. You know, at its own pace. And we just have to be there waiting, you know, patiently. Okay, that's enough for today. So, anybody want to come up with a few more interesting, sweat-inducing questions since it's so cold? Okay. Any sweat-inducing questions? No? You're warm enough? Okay. Pass on to Saul and more announcements.